Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Jeremy Hofson is off today. We wish you a meaningful Memorial Day. And it's one President Trump began, as every president before him did, at Arlington National Cemetery.
To every Gold Star family who honors us with your presence, you lost sons and daughters, husbands and wives, mothers and fathers. They each had their own names, their own stories, their own beautiful dreams. But they were all angels sent to us by God, and they all share one title in common, and that is the title of hero.
President Trump today at Arlington National Cemetery. This morning, the president also tweeted a salute to the men and women he said made the ultimate sacrifice in service to America, home of the free, because of the brave. But it's a Twitter storm after he arrived home this weekend from his first trip abroad that people are talking about. The president slamming reports that his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, tried to open a secret backdoor communication channel with Russia, and also castigating what he called the fake news media. NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley is here. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Robin.
And let's start with those weekend tweets. The president responding to reports that came out while he was abroad that Jared Kushner, his son-in-law and senior advisor, is the focus of that investigation into possible collusion with Russia and the president's campaign, more specifically that Kushner spoke with the Russian ambassador about opening these secret communication channels to talk about things like Syria. Tell us more about what we know.
This was first reported by the Washington Post and later followed up by other news outlets that, yes, Kushner spoke with the Russian ambassador in early December, that is, during the transition period, before the Trump team had actually moved into office. And he floated the idea of setting up this secret communication channel for transition officials to use, including Michael Flynn, who, of course, would go on to become the short-lived national security advisor and who was ultimately fired over misrepresenting his contacts with the Russian ambassador.
And we understand that Michael Flynn was in the room in the Trump Tower when this conversation was held. Well, President Trump and his administration have defended Jared Kushner. Here's Department of Homeland Security Chief John Kelly on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday.
I know Jared. He's a great guy, decent guy. His number one interest really is the nation. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways to communicate back channel, you know, publicly with other countries. I don't see any big issue here.
Well, a couple things, Scott. First of all, in that comment, it sounds as if it's an acknowledgement that Kushner tried to do what he said to have tried to do. But what are others saying about how normal that would be?
Well, one thing we should point out is that there's no evidence this secret communication channel was ever actually established. But the question is, why would Kushner and the transition team have wanted a communication channel to Russia operating outside the sort of traditional foreign policy apparatus? That is, sort of, why would they want to go around the State Department and others in the U.S. government to have this back channel?
Yeah. Well, now we are, as everyone is, talking about, you know, Jared Kushner instead of about the president's trip, which we understand his aides think was, you know, the most successful run that he's had as president. And it's been sidetracked perhaps by the conversations about Kushner pushed by the president's tweets. But first of all, how successful do most think the trip was?
Well, you know, the White House staff, I think, breathed a big sigh of relief that the president wasn't tweeting throughout this trip. They kept him pretty busy, and I don't know, maybe they didn't sign him up for the international data plan. But then he came back to Washington and immediately took to Twitter once again. And, you know, this is going to be under scrutiny not only by those of us in the news media now, but also by the special counsel that is investigating potential ties between the Trump team and the Russians. And so there is a real consensus, I think, that steps need to be taken to try to discipline this president and his Twitter habit. But that's much easier said than done.
Well, and looking at the week ahead, fired FBI Director James Comey was supposed to testify sometime after Memorial Day. President Trump is tweeting about health care and tax reform. There are also reports that there might be a White House shakeup. Thoughts on the week ahead?
Yeah, the president's tweets on the tax reform, he boasts that they're ahead of schedule. That's a little hard to see. Initially, they thought they might actually have tax reform by August. That seems very unlikely. And then a cryptic tweet on health care, where he was suggesting that more money be put in to make health care better. Mm. Of course, just last week, we got that report from the congressional forecasters saying the plan passed by Republicans in the House would leave 23 million more Americans uninsured than the current system.
Yeah. NPR's White House correspondent Scott Horsley. A thoughtful Memorial Day to you, sir.
Thank you, Robin.
Yeah. To Wyoming now. Why? Well, a one-size-fits-all national science curriculum outlining rules for how teachers should teach science has been controversial. In states like Wyoming, where the economy relies on fossil fuels, teaching kids that humans are in part to blame for climate change can be touchy. But this year, for the first time, Wyoming kids learned about climate change using science standards especially adapted to Wyoming's energy-friendly realities. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports.
Back in 2014, like most other states at the time, Wyoming was poised to adopt the Department of Education's Next Generation Science Standards for the state's school districts. Democratic State Senator Chris Rothfuss was a big fan of those, but he remembers a lot of grumbling from his fellow lawmakers.
There's generally been a concern with standards that somehow these are national standards, that the feds are trying to tell us what to learn. And so there was a general backlash, I think, towards that.
Rothfuss says many Wyoming lawmakers were worried that next generation standards would require teachers to teach that climate change is human caused, a controversial idea in the third largest energy producing state in the country. Rothfuss recalls one busy week at legislature. Not many lawmakers noticed when an amendment was added to the state budget bill. It would strip the science standards program of its funding.
People are tired at the end of the day. Sometimes things slip through the cracks, and that may have been one of those pieces of legislation that if the House had really had a lot of robust debate, might not have passed, but there wasn't any debate, and it passed.
Eventually, Rothfuss helped make sure funding for a science curriculum was restored. But soon after, Jillian Baylow was elected state superintendent, having given her word to slow down the process of adopting science standards. Baylow's approach was to collect lots of public input. She says what she heard from Wyomingites was that people wanted to mold those national standards into something uniquely Wyoming and take a novel approach to teaching climate change.
One of my goals was to encourage students to use the scientific process to determine and to deduce factual science.
In other words, let kids make up their own minds about the causes of climate change. University of Wyoming geologist Sarah Conrad sat on Baylow's task force, working for months with parents and teachers to hammer out these Wyoming-made standards. She says it was tough.
Because there's certain words that get people fired up, and we tried to avoid the words that could be controversial. And in changing the words, it wasn't that we changed the science. Again, we didn't want to do that. We wanted to make sure we're really sticking to rigorous science standards.
As a glacier expert, Conrad takes issue with people who say they do or don't believe in climate change.
I mean, what science is a process, and it's a system. It's not a belief.
Conrad is worried about how quickly Wyoming's glaciers are shrinking. But she says the goal of the task force was to find a way to express accurate science everyone could agree on. Nowhere in Wyoming science standards does it say that humans cause climate change, even though a NASA survey shows 97% of scientists agree it's extremely likely that climate warming trends are due to human activities. Conrad gives an example of how the task force finally did agree to describe the effects of greenhouse gases. They flipped the language. So instead of saying that an increase of the gases causes warming,
so we changed the example to say a decrease in greenhouse gases causes a decrease in global temperatures, which would cause an increase in glacial ice, which is exactly true, and that's what happens to start an ice age.
Three, two, one, go!
On the sidewalk outside their school, a group of middle schoolers is racing some solar-powered cars they built. As part of their climate change study, they're learning how different kinds of energy affect global warming. They've studied wind, methane, and of course, coal. Sixth grader Jesse Prather is worried about how Wyoming's number one industry affects global temperatures.
Gillette is one of the best places to get coal on the planet. And then they get coal and they take it out and they go burn it. And we burn some of it too, so we're just like, foof, up into the atmosphere.
But seventh grader Anna Raessler is more forgiving.
We're able to go to school right now because of the money that our economy is making. And we need money to help the environment.
On a whiteboard, their science teacher, Andy Pannell, posts global temperatures each day. But Pannell says he tries to strike a balance.
I'm a fifth-generation Wyomingite. I understand where my paycheck comes from. And I was a little nervous that I was going to be teaching climate change, that I was going to be set against, you know, the culture here in Wyoming.
Now that he's taught the class, Pannell says the lawmakers who defunded science standards had nothing to worry about.
If the legislators were worried that the energy industry would be demonized by trying to study climate change, I think that actually the opposite has happened. I think a lot of the kids actually have more of an appreciation that there's just trade-offs for the way that we do business.
Out on the solar car racetrack, the kids seem up to the task of fixing things. Seventh grader Rowan Ahern is trying to get the cars to drive.
I'm not too keen on the engineering of these vehicles.
Can I fix that one?
This doesn't seem to be turning all that much.
A little while later, a few of the kids return with a solar car that's working much better. For Here and Now, I'm Melody Edwards in Laramie.
Memorial Day was first called Decoration Day, launched right after the Civil War as a time to decorate the graves of the Union dead. Now, while a reminder for most of the cost of war, it's also the informal portal to summer. And for thousands of kids since 1877, that means camp, thanks to the Fresh Air Fund. The New York-based nonprofit sends poor inner-city kids out to the country in 13 states and Canada to live with host families and enjoy nature. The fund also provides college and job mentoring all year round, so we thought they deserved an encore. We spoke with Fatima Shama, the then new executive director of the Fresh Air Fund, last year as part of our View from the Top series. She says she could have easily been a fresh air kid herself.
I was born and raised in the Bronx, and my parents were immigrants to this country. I lived with public housing right up the street. Some of New York City's lowest performing schools were my zoned schools. And to be really honest, summer camp for me was going to our local public school for free breakfast and playing in the street, and then going back to the school for free lunch, and then going to our local public library for the afternoon.
Yeah, and maybe opening a fire hydrant when it got
super hot. I almost said that, but yeah, you said it for me. Exactly.
Well, there you go. But so that brings our first question. Yes, this tremendous organization sends, you know, 4,000 kids in the summer to those 13 states we mentioned in Canada, another 3,000 to the five fresh air camps up in Fishkill, New York, and upstate. But how do you decide? Because for every 1,000 kids you send, 3,000 or 4,000 don't go. You know, it's how do you make those decisions?
Yeah. Yeah. So in New York City, there are nearly 2 million kids who would be eligible based on age range, and a third of whom live in poverty. So we estimate about 600,000 kids in New York City live in poverty. And we at the Fresh Air Fund aim to recruit those children. One of the things we try to do are find children who would be eligible for free lunch as evident to participate in the program. And we get 11,000 applications annually for what you've just identified as 7,000 seats. And at this point, it is first come, first serve, but we are quite cognizant of the need. One of the things we aim to do are find more families who would be willing to host more children, because that is something we can continue to grow. And it is astounding to me because, as you noted, our history is actually started 140 years ago. And the Reverend Parsons actually started this, I have to just say, my background is in health and education policy. This was a public health solution. Children in New York City's Lower East Side tenements were living with tuberculosis, and it was spreading because of the fact that kids had no access to cleansing their lungs.
Fresh air. They needed fresh air.
Precisely. And today, the fact is that we don't have tuberculosis, but we have asthma, and we have communities riddled with crime and gun violence, and we have obesity and a lack of open space for kids to actually just play and be kids. So still, the Fresh Air Fund is as relevant as it was 140 years ago, and we need families who would continue to welcome children from our low-income communities into their neighborhoods and communities.
You make so many great points here that this isn't just, oh, wouldn't it be nice for a kid to see a piece of clover, which in fact it would be,
right?
But that it's a health issue. And I just want to note that in the 1800s, The immigrants helped were predominantly Irish and Italian.
That's right.
I'm just curious. You know, the immigrant population keeps changing every 100 years or so.
That's right.
And the Irish and the Italian, we have to constantly remind ourselves, we're as vilified, you know, as immigrants are today. Mm-hmm. But do you see there, is there, when you keep saying we need host families, is there any, is it more difficult to place children of color, which are predominantly the children being considered today?
I have to tell you, I think that I have had the pleasure of visiting families within the many states that host our kids. And I think people come to this who are interested in opening up their hearts and their homes to help children less fortunate than themselves. The truth is that the immigrants of yesterday are not the same as today. And so what once was Irish and German and Italian immigrants today are Chinese and Mexican and children from West Africa and a large population of American-born, African-American children. But I have yet to find so many families that would say to me, well, those weren't the kids we were hoping to help.
Yeah.
Part of it is our making sure we tell that story. That immigration is dynamic and new immigrants today look differently than ones 30, 40, hundreds of years ago. But that is what makes actually the New York story and American story, in my opinion, so rich, is that it is this dynamic experience that in every, as you noted, every decade or two or three changes.
What are your challenges? Because you do have challenges finding the host families. Why?
I think the reality is once upon a time, families had summers that were more relaxed, perhaps. There were more moms who were home. Now we have many homes that two parents are working. Mm-hmm. And so 2-week summer vacations are sort of their reality and their ability to not only have their own downtime as a family, but also invite someone to be a part of that might be more complicated. We do go through a pretty rigorous background check process, an interview process to make sure that a home is a child, one of the homes that has volunteered to do this is a home where you and I would send our children. And so it's an interview, it's a home visit, it's a background check process, it's reviewing and speaking to 4 different references. So it's fairly rigorous, and some folks may or may not be up for that deep of a challenge. But for those that go through it, and we have 4,000 of whom who do, we're really delighted that they've done that work. And we certainly know that as our applications continue to come into our office, we can easily send more children to homes who would be willing to go through that process.
Well, then there's the fact that camp, or for many of these kids, it was not even camp. It's just to go get somewhere where there's fresh air. Mm. But for thousands, it's the camps up in upstate New York. I urge people, I mean, if you get the New York Times, you read the stories about the fresh air fund and how much the kids are getting out of it. But in camps in general across the country, it's become this competitive business, super expensive camps where kids go to study computers and some camps focused on getting into college. How do you compete with that without losing that original mission of we just want to make sure kids have fun where there's grass?
You know, I have to say, I mean, I don't think we compete with it, largely because I think we're giving opportunity for children who would likely never have the opportunity. And I think that's both what we pride ourselves on, but it's also what makes us uniquely special and special for the families we're trying to both recruit and serve. So what absolutely happens at camp is fun. But it is fun that I will define as layered with enrichment. And so for many of our children, they've never seen lakes before. And the idea of swimming in one is a whole new experience. Swimming, actually, as I've learned from many of our children and our families, is something that is quite unique for our kids. Most of them don't know how to swim. And in their 2 weeks with us, they go through this rigorous process. But the idea that while they're learning how to swim, they're in this water where they're learning that beneath their feet is an actual living ecosystem. And we talk about the pHs of water and the differences between pools and lake and actually what could be more natural. And amid that, they're actually learning or hearing sounds of birds around them. And so someone is teaching them what those birds could be. And so embedded in all of this learning that is true fun Are all these new vocabulary words or all these scientific terms that become real because back in the classroom, they're going to get introduced in some way, shape, or form in the life sciences or in a science class? And what actually is quite real to be to sort of put on a little bit of an ed policy hat is this is what differentiates so many middle-income children to low-income children. Kids have these experiences that, as you know, parents pay for. In low-income families, our children don't necessarily have these and therefore may differentiate them from being able to have the vocabulary or experiences that they can then write about, right? Someone learning how to swim is a story in their writing class. And it's these experiences that truly are still fun, but really are allowing enrichment to happen in a different way.
So Fatima Jama, again, executive director for the Fresh Air Fund, you've talked about needing to recruit kids. You've said that when you were a kid, again, the daughter of a Palestinian and a Brazilian, they met in Brazil, and your parents, who are immigrants, didn't know about the fund. So you're trying to get through to these immigrant communities today. You're trying to find more families at a time when they're, you know, not all families are home over the summer to host kids at their home as opposed to the camps. But also just, you know, money. What is your biggest financial challenge?
Well, we have an annual operating budget of nearly $17 million, and to send 7,000 children to experiences, to keep up the infrastructure at our camps, to continue to grow our work and to ensure and minimize risks to all of our children, these are very expensive things. So we raise 75% of our money from individual donors. And we need to always ensure that we're maintaining those relationships and grooming them and growing them. Not different from any nonprofit, but for us, it really is about children and being able to serve them at this intersection of both what is a summer experience, but really a summer experience, as we've talked about, that can start changing a child's life.
Fatima Jama, executive director of the Fresh Air Fund, the nonprofit that brings summer experiences to lower-income kids from New York. Fatima, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Most Memorial Day services across the country today will feature a short, sublime tune that dates back to the Civil War. Taps is generally played on a bugle or trumpet at military funerals or flag ceremonies. David C. Barnett from Here and Now contributor WCPN IdeaStream spoke with a couple of Cleveland musicians about putting their stamp on a song with more than 150 years of history.
My name is Teresa May, and I'm a trumpet player, and I perform with the Cleveland Brassworks Quintet. For most of us trumpet players, it's not terribly challenging. I think for me, as a younger trumpet player, it was cool to be able to play a tune on the trumpet without having to move any valves or anything. It's only a few notes, but when I actually learned about the meaning, it changed the way that I wasn't just, this actually means something, and people come up to me and tell me that what I've played and my music has spoken to them, and they're glad that they were able to have that piece of live music in their service. I feel like I want it to be the best performance, to be able to add that special piece of music that the family really wants to hear and that a lot of people have that special bond with. So when you go into a memorial service of any sort, you want to play it to the best of your ability and really let the meaning of the music speak for itself.
My name is Michael Sachs. I'm the principal trumpet with the Cleveland Orchestra for the last 29 years. Really, with taps, you want that to be, you know, just as pristine and beautiful and lyrical and as perfect as it can be. I mean, look, the family's not going to notice whether you play it perfectly. It's the sentiment that's offered is the most important part of it. Probably the most famous story of somebody not playing it exactly perfectly was when John F. Kennedy was buried at Arlington. And Keith Clark, who was the bugler who played that, cracked one of the notes. But you know, you look at the circumstances, you know, he was standing on the hill where he was going to render the taps for literally, I think, 5 or 6 hours waiting for the procession. And it was a very, very cold day. And to stand out there and you're freezing cold, your horn is freezing cold, and he couldn't play any warm-up notes or anything, to just after 5, 6 hours put out up to your face, I mean, anyone in that situation would have likely done probably worse than he did. It was, in some ways, some people looked at it as it was a very mournful sort of symbolism of the moment, of this horrible moment where the president was assassinated and was a young president at that. I mean, there's so many layers of the meaning of what it means historically and the meaning of what it means in the moment. And I mean, I don't want to be melodramatic, but really the sacred honor it is to offer that to a grieving family. And I think just everything that that means really all kind of comes together in that moment with those 24 notes.
Michael Sacks of the Cleveland Orchestra with his views this Memorial Day on the power of taps. We also heard from Teresa May, a trumpeter for the Cleveland Brassworks Quintet. Their story was produced by David C. Barnett from Here and Now contributor WCPN IdeaStream. The Memorial Day is about remembering, so let's do that. With Allison Jaslow, Executive Director of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and a former U.S. Army captain who served 2 combat tours in Iraq. In the first, 2 of her men were killed in action. Allison, welcome back.
Thank you, Robin.
We're also joined by Amy Nyberger-Miller. Her brother Christopher was killed in Iraq in 2007. She now works with various veterans groups and with the Memorial Day Flowers Foundation. They place flowers on veterans' graves. Amy, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Allison, we'll start with you. Difficult day. Your thoughts?
For those of us who have served, and I hope every American, it's most important that we honor the sacrifice of those who have fallen. Even risking my life in Iraq, I still can't even relate to folks like Amy who have paid the ultimate sacrifice or been close by blood to somebody who's given the ultimate sacrifice. And I think you're talking to 2 folks today who are a little closer to that, but most Americans aren't. So I hope that when everyone observes Memorial Day, that they really sort of consider Amy's experience, experience of her families, and experience of service members who've lost those who are close to them.
Amy, I guess maybe we should ask you. As we said, this was your brother, Christopher Nyberger, killed in Iraq in 2007, just 22. I want to hear about him because that's what the day is about, remembering. But what should we say? I sometimes say, have a thoughtful Memorial Day. But you know, what do you say on this day?
I think for families, one of the most important things people can do is ask us about our loved ones. In our situation, my brother died almost 10 years ago. And we recognize his birthday and the day he died. You know, those are dates that come up on the calendar every year. But Memorial Day is the day our country recognizes those who've paid the ultimate price for our freedoms. And it's nice to have people ask us what his life was like, not just to acknowledge that he died, but to acknowledge that he really lived and to ask us, what was he like? What was his personality like?
Well, what was he like?
My brother, Chris, was the middle of my 3 brothers. I'm a bit older. So if they were playing a joke on mom and dad, they were probably trying to play it on me, too. And he was always a very thoughtful person. He could be a bit of a loner. He tended to have a few close friends. But he was always growing up part of a trio because my brothers were a group of 3. And he was wild and funny and very exciting. He loved history and books and travel. He really enjoyed exploring. He was stationed in Germany for a while and really enjoyed going out to look at old World War II sites and meet people. And to him, that was just part of what life was about.
Well, he also, we understand, in addition to helping people in your hometown there, Gainesville, Florida, worked in an orphanage in Mexico. The minister at his memorial service told a story about his hair, that he had very long hair.
Oh, that's right. He did, yes.
And he would tuck it up.
Our church had a project where we went and volunteered at an orphanage in Mexico. And Chris had kind of gone through this phase where he had grown out his hair really long and it was kind of scraggly. And I think he was worried he would offend someone. So every day, even though it was really hot, he would shove his hair up into this baseball cap and just go around like that. So, yeah. And actually, after he died, we raised some money as a family to help the orphanage because he had given so much there.
We also know he was a member of Boy Scout Troop 454 and achieved the rank of Eagle Scout in 2002. Look, I know had he gotten to live a long life, he still would remember the Boy Scouts. We all remember our scouting experiences. Mm-hmm. We remember our troop numbers. But it strikes me that things like that become particularly important when somebody dies at 22. You know, that list of accomplishments is even more important because it was shortened.
I certainly felt a compulsion to try to collect, say, pictures of Chris and memories that people had of him, because there was this recognition that his life had stopped at age 22 and 3 days. Yeah. And we won't get those other memories. And I think that's something that's really hard about it. And at the same time, some of those memories connect to things now. Like, for example, when my own daughter joined Girl Scouts, and she's a Daisy. Okay, so she's 7 years old. To me, the first time I saw my daughter take that pledge and be part of those experiences, that connected to something very deep in me, not just my own experiences growing up, but also to my brother. Mm-hmm. This is where those values start. This is where those things are learned. We're still all connected to that.
Well, Allison, I know you're listening to this with a heavy heart. You served, as we said, 2 tours in Iraq. It's not a brother like Amy, but it's a brotherhood. And 2 soldiers were killed in your first deployment.
Private Christopher Kilpatrick and Second Lieutenant Clifford Gadsden. He's the one who I wear in a bracelet every day of my life, ever since I was able to make one when I got home from that deployment. Because more than anything else, what hit home for me is that I very much could have been in his shoes. I would have made the decisions that he made. You know, I'm lucky that I'm sitting here today, and I think it sort of underscores why my life work has been to share the stories of either the fallen, like Lieutenant Gadsden, or Private Kilpatrick, or those of us who've come back with wounds and are still trudging along.
Well, again, we want to remember them. Tell us something about them.
Smiles from ear to ear, both of them. Lieutenant Gadsden is a guy who all of his soldiers just really looked up to and respected. You know, he was a success story. He's from South Carolina, was able to put himself through college. And in the Army, we often tell people to soldier on. Mm-hmm. Nothing underscores that any more than when I was asked to be Gadsden's summary court officer, which essentially means that you go into somebody's quarters afterwards and you inventory and catalog all of their belongings. You know, I'll never forget the painting that he had some of the locals do of, I think it was his wife. I don't know if it was also a family photo. You know, and so getting a chance to see not only the things that mattered to him and learn a little bit more about his life through that process, but also to see that he was somebody who was deployed and still thinking about his family day in and day out and taking the time to get gifts for them while he was deployed and dealing with what we were dealing with. Mm-hmm. Is something that I'll just never forget.
I also have something that my brother got for me in Iraq. It's a prayer rug that he bought from someone who must have come by the base, and that came back, came to me actually before he died. I had that, and that's definitely one of my more prized possessions that came back. And, you know, it is very sober when those black trunks come back and you realize that's what came back. That's it. That's what's left. And at the same time, there were things there, like a lot of unanswered questions, too. I went through the photos that were on Chris's digital camera that came back with his things. And there were some pictures there from when he was in Iraq of his hands, and they were covered in soot, and his boots, and they were covered in soot, and his face looked really bad. And I thought, something happened that day, and he didn't tell us about this. Mm-hmm. Something happened while he was out on patrol that day, I think, and maybe he took those pictures to remind himself he was alive. So there's some things there that we don't really fully understand, but, you know, we do treasure the memories we have.
I guess the only thing I would say in closing is I very much appreciate you all taking the time to share stories. 99% of Americans haven't served in the most recent war, and just another sliver are closely connected to them. And so it's important that those who don't have their own stories, who certainly, as Amy said, will remember in the way that's best for them, need to hear other ones.
I have to admit, I was driving in my car the other day, and I kept hearing ads for Memorial Day sales and had to keep changing the station. I don't want to take away the fun that anyone else has. You know, I'm in our own family, we went to Arlington last year and worked with the flowers event. And in the evening, we took our daughter swimming. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a way to do both things, to honor the fallen and to still include some of the other things that people like to do.
Amy Nyberger Miller, her brother, Army Specialist Christopher Nyberger, was killed in Iraq in 2007. Allison Jaslow, a former Army captain, she served two tours in Iraq. Two friends were killed. Allison is Executive Director of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Amy works with various veterans groups. I want to wish you both the best day possible. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And a little shout-out here. Congratulations, Conroe, Texas. According to new census figures just out a couple days ago, you, Conroe, earned the title of fastest-growing large city in the U.S. last year. In fact, four of the five fastest-growing cities were in Texas. The outlier was Greenville, South Carolina. But if you look at the whole list, the top 15, Americans are moving south and west. We're joined, as we are every Monday, by Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, good Memorial Day to you.
Good Memorial Day to you.
Right. And it strikes us, Memorial Day weekend is when a lot of people are moving. Why? Where are they not moving if they're moving to the south and the west?
Two important themes here. First, Americans now are less likely to switch jobs, less likely to move between states, or even create new companies than they were 30 years ago. There's a little bit of stasis in Americans, even during the summertime. So it's important to note, as we're talking about migratory patterns, that Americans just aren't moving the way they were in the 1970s or even at the beginning of the 20th century. But where are they moving? As you said, they're moving away from expensive, dense areas, cities, and they are moving toward the sun. Toward less dense suburbs in the south and in the west. Of the 10 large cities that added the most people in the last year, eight of the 10 were in Texas, Arizona, California. So sun.
Only one city in the Midwest, Ankeny, Iowa, topped the list. No cities in the Northeast were among the country's fastest growing, and people are still moving there. But I'm looking at the other Texas cities. Conroe City was number one, but Frisco City, McKinney City, as we said, Greenville, South Carolina is in there, Georgetown, Texas. Now, we said Conroe, fastest growing, 11 times the growth of the average in the country. But the mayor says it's because of a new ExxonMobil campus that opened there in 2015. Really, is oil still bringing people to Texas?
It's complicated because on the one hand, I think for in Conroe's case, if you're a small city and you have a new campus from Exxon open up, that's going to bring a heck of a lot of jobs. That's wonderful for the local economy. But overall, you would think, wait, why is Texas leading the list considering that oil prices have been low for the last few years? Well, it's not the 1980s anymore. It's not the period where an oil crash could bring down the entire regional economy. You have a much more diversified economy across Texas. You have leisure and hospitality in San Antonio. You have health care across the state. You have a growth in food services and finances, and even local government jobs are growing. So not only do you have a lot of people moving to Texas from within the United States, you also have a lot of immigrants moving to Texas as well. And that influx of population is just creating all of these jobs that have to be more well-rounded than just people digging and drilling for oil.
Well, let's just look at some of the others because it's fun. You know, you got Bend, Oregon at 6, Buckeye, Arizona, Murfreesboro, Tennessee, Lehigh, Utah, Cedar Park, Texas again in there, Meridian, Idaho. So, lots of those cities that are, not in the Northeast, not in the Midwest. You say these new numbers tell us how much has and hasn't changed since the recession. What do you mean by that?
There was a sense, I think, after the Great Recession that we were seeing this renaissance of the city, that the city was coming back in New York and D.C. and Portland and Seattle. It was these big cities, especially those in the north, that were coming back. But population growth in big cities has now shrunk for five consecutive years, according to research by Jed Kolko, an economist I follow. So what you have is a situation where a lot of members of the media are concentrating even more in a handful of expensive coastal cities, but the rest of the country is slowly fanning out to the sunny suburbs. So I think sometimes if you just ask a reporter, you know, what's happening to the cities, they'll describe a renaissance, they'll describe a rebirth. But then you open up these census figures that are looking at the entire country, and they're describing a real fanning out toward the sunny suburbs in the West and in the South.
Perhaps something election analysts might want to be taking a look at.
Yes, exactly.
But interesting, among the country's biggest cities, Chicago was the only one to lose population in 2016, in part because there's a long-term trend there of African Americans moving to the suburbs from the big city. What do you read into that? Is it, you know, good news about African Americans moving up and moving out? What's there?
Yeah, this is a complicated one as well. Chicago's population has been shrinking not just last year, but in years before, more than any other major metro area in the country. And as you pointed out, it's not the white population that's falling, or even Latino or Asian populations. Chicago has lost more than a quarter of its black population since the 1980s. And on the one hand, it is good for families to move toward opportunity, but this is also a reflection of the violence and the poverty and the lack of stable job opportunities in the South and West side of the city. And that's not a good thing. Mm-hmm. So I think Chicago does have a lot to reckon with, particularly when it comes to the way that black families feel like they've been disenfranchised, particularly in the South and West of that city.
Right. Derek, we only have a minute here, but I want to touch on something else that the Census Bureau report shows. It's a report on young adults, and it's got disturbing information about how much money young men are making.
Yeah, we've definitely seen that young men in particular are having a harder time achieving upward mobility, that you have a lot of young men who are going to college, maybe dropping out of college, staying in their parents' house for a long period of time and not necessarily moving up the income ladder like they were a couple generations ago. And this, I also think is going to be something that might show up in the politics of America in the next few election cycles.
Let's pick up on that another time. Derek Thompson, Senior Editor at The Atlantic. Thank you, as always.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young. Jeremy Hobson's off today. It's Here and Now.